podcast, Doing the Einstein Twist, with Megan Argo, Melanie Jaunt, Jen Gupta, Libby Jones, Tim O'Brien, and Mark Herbert. The Jobcast, May 2011 Extra Edition. Hello, and welcome to the Jobcast. I'm Libby Jones, and joining me today is Mark and Melanie.
Hello.
Hello.
In this month's extra show, we have exciting new results from Herschel. Dr. Tim O'Brien answers your astronomical questions. And first, before all of that, we have more interviews from the National Astronomical Meeting in Llandudno.
Okay, so I'm talking to Karen Masters, who is here on behalf of LOFAR. So tell us all about LOFAR.
LOFAR stands for the Low Frequency Array. It's a pan-European radio telescope. It's got stations, the bulk of it is in the Netherlands, and it's run out of the Netherlands, but there's also stations in Germany and Sweden, France and the UK. The UK station is in Hampshire, and it has almost 200 antennas, literally in a field, actually. Right over the fence they grow the mushrooms that they sell at Waitrose. It's a really a nice rural location away from all sources of, or many sources of FM radio. LOFAR works at two frequency bands, just below and just above the FM radio bands. I mean, it has two types of antennas that do that. The low band antennas, they look a little bit like tents but without canvas. One of the fun things about LOFAR is that the station in the UK was actually built with the help of volunteer labour. The low band antennas, the LBAs, were quite simple to put together, and so we didn't need any kind of massive technical expertise. So students and postdocs from universities in the southeast of the UK in the SETNET region, including lots of people from the University of Portsmouth, where I work, went to Gibraltar, and we spent a week commuting to Gibraltar and going and building these antennas, and we built 96 of the LBAs in a week. It's quite fun because all the bits are sent from the Netherlands. It's a little bit like a flat pack telescope, so these two lorries arrived with all the parts, and then we had to put it together. The high band antenna is a little bit more complicated, and we're put together with the help of forklift trucks and professionals a little bit later in the summer. And the UK station was opened in September by Jocelyn Bell, and we had a nice opening ceremony. And we had the first flight image, including the UK station, the French station, and one of the German stations, along with the Netherlands, several of the stations in the Netherlands. I think they have almost 30 now working in the Netherlands. That first light image was produced earlier this year and showed the massive increase in resolution you get when you go from just the core in the Netherlands to including these outer international stations, or making the International LOFAR Telescope. It's a multi-acronym acronym, ILT.
So what kind of science is LOFAR intended to do?
LOFAR has several key science goals. One of the biggest is probably trying to detect the epoch of reionization. So this is the period in the universe when the first stars turned on. So if you go right back to the Big Bang, you have sort of the hot plasma at the Big Bang, and we know people probably have heard of the CMB radiation. That's when the electrons first combined with protons, and the protons restreamed across the universe. After that time, the universe was full of neutral hydrogen, just hydrogen atoms floating around, and very little structure. There were no stars, no galaxies, nothing like that. Very slowly, stuff collected under gravity, and eventually parts of the universe got dense enough for the first stars to turn on. When that happens, the first stars ionise all that neutral hydrogen, and that's what we call reionisation. Now, neutral hydrogen emits a very characteristic radio line at 21 centimetres, redshifted, you know, by these massive redshifts in the early universe. That's in the frequency range detectable by LOFAR, we hope. And we hope that we're going to detect this step when all of that neutral hydrogen suddenly gets ionised, and pin down the time at which the first stars were born in the universe.
Okay, so the hydrogen gets ionised and it stops emitting that 21 centimetre line.
That's exactly right, yeah. And so what you should see is this global step. You have lots of 21 centimetre radiation, and then suddenly you have very little, and think fairly quickly. Yeah. LOFAR can also do lots of other science, like, for example, it's very, very, very good at detecting pulsars. But going back to the old way that we detected pulsars, you know, back in the 60s, sort of wires in a field. But now we've got 3,000 of them, 5,000 of them, sorry, all over Europe, making currently the largest radio telescope in the world, the most sensitive radio telescope in the world.
And presumably much, much more powerful computers than you had back in the 1960s.
Much, much, much more powerful computers. As I understand it, Jocelyn Bell detected pulsars by rolling strips of paper across the floor of her office. LOFAR is controlled by a supercomputer in the Netherlands and wouldn't be possible without the fibre high-speed internet through fibre optics. Actually, if you consider the UK station, the parts, the components, the physical hardware is a negligible fraction of the cost. What we're spending all the money on is the high-speed internet connection to the Netherlands.
So how does LOFAR fit in with all the other telescopes that are currently being built around the world in the lead-up to things like the Square Kilometre Array?
Well, LOFAR is really a pathfinder for the SKA. It's really the first of its kind of this new generation of radio telescopes, which have very simple components but are enabled by the massive increases in computing that we've had in the future. Europe is really leading the way in this field. In the US, they're building the long wavelength array, which is rather similar to LOFAR. It's going to be situated somewhere in the western US. And in Australia, they also have similar telescopes under construction.
Okay, so you're also involved with GalaxyZoo. Tell me a little bit about what you've been doing with that project.
Well, the most recent result we've had out from GalaxyZoo was the first result from the GalaxyZoo 2 classifications. So in Zoo 1, we just asked people to decide if the galaxy was spiral or elliptical. And in Zoo 2, we asked for a little bit more information. And one of the things that we asked about was whether or not the spiral galaxies or the disk galaxies had bars going across the centre. And this is just a linear structure that crosses the centre of, between a third and two-thirds of spiral galaxies. So we actually took an early look at the results from that because we got so interested, because we saw one of my earlier results from GalaxyZoo was about red spirals. So most spiral galaxies are blue. And they're blue because the light that you see in them is dominated by young, hot blue stars that are very bright. Most ellipticals are red, and that's because they're not forming any stars anymore. And those young, hot, bright blue stars have all died off, leaving only the dim, red, less massive stars. And GalaxyZoo found this population of spirals that are as red as most ellipticals. And one of the things we noticed about them was that they seemed to have more bars than the normal blue spirals. So we took this early look at the bar classifications from Zoo 2, and we found that continued in the whole spiral population, that there's this strong correlation between colour and whether or not the galaxy has a bar. The red spirals are much more likely to have bars than bluer spirals. So that seems really intriguing and maybe suggests that bars, or sort of internal evolution from a bar, might be doing more to the spirals than we previously thought. What a bar does is, because it's not symmetric, it's not axially symmetric, it breaks the symmetry in the disk, and so it lets material move in and out along the bar, basically. So that's really curious. But I think actually my current theory is that the bars are more of a side effect. Once the spiral becomes red, you're much more likely to have a bar. And the reason is that it turns out bars form really, really quickly in any disk galaxy. So the big question really is why some don't have it. And actually it turns out that's probably related to them killing themselves. Because they move material in and out along the bar, once they form, they basically self-destruct. Is one of the theories that's going around, that people have done work on. But it seems that once you get rid of the gas in a galaxy, and the gas would be the fuel for star formation, so the red spirals, we think, don't have a lot of this gas because they're no longer forming stars. That's what's turned them red. So you got rid of the gas, and so once you build the bar, it sticks around for ages. I think that's probably what's going on, and what I've been working on lately is trying to look at whether or not spiral galaxies that have more gas in them, more fuel for star formation, are more likely to have bars or not.
Okay, cool. So yeah, you think about galaxies as having lots of gas in them and that gas being used up in star formation, mm-hmm. but there's lots of other ways it can get dissipated as well, aren't there?
Well, that's right. Actually, one of the early puzzles about the Milky Way, if you count the amount of gas there is in the disk of the Milky Way and you count the amount of stars that are forming, you quite quickly come to the realisation that you're going to use up all the gas really, really quickly. And so there was this model that came up that there must be gas raining onto the disk of the galaxy from a hot halo. So what we think is probably going on with the red spirals is that gas that's up in the halo, high off the disk and is very hot, has been stripped off. So there's no source of replenishment for the gas in the disk. And that's what's causing the spirals to become red and making them be more likely to have a bar.
And what gets rid of the gas in the halo?
It would be an interaction, probably, with another galaxy. It would be because the spiral is falling into a more massive halo, and then all that gas gets stripped off into the more massive halo, or maybe some sort of companion galaxy has come through and taken off all the gas.
So these red spirals, sort of, you see them more in galaxy groups and clusters and things?
Yeah, there's quite a clear correlation that they're more likely to be present in intermediate environments. We actually see them in all environments. Which tells you that it can't be a really strong environmental process. It can't be something like an interaction with a cluster, or it can't be something that requires a cluster that's turning them red. But this sort of gentle stripping off of gas in the halo can happen at quite low densities, can happen pretty much anywhere, but it is more likely to happen in intermediate environments, and so that's what makes you think that's a good candidate for the process.
So Galaxies is doing all these really cool things. What's sort of next? What's on the horizon for Galaxies as a project as a whole?
Well, what's running now at the Galaxy Zoo website, www.galaxyzoo.org, is Hubble Zoo. And this is, instead of Zoo 1 and Zoo 2 used images from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. So those are very local galaxies, effectively. Obviously, they're a long, long way away by human scales, but there's a galaxies, you know, really close by on galactic scales. In Hubble Zoo, we've moved to images from the Hubble Space Telescope, and these are now galaxies that are much, much further away, about half the age of the universe away. And so what we're hoping to do is be able to look at the evolution of morphology over the history of the universe. And so one thing in particular, we can look at how bars differed when the universe was half its current age and then, you know, now, and all sorts of other things as well.
Okay, cool. Sounds good. Look forward to hearing about it.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for that, Megan.
And now here's Jen talking to Hayley Gomez about using Herschel to look at dust in galaxies.
Okay, I'm here with Dr. Hayley Gomez from Cardiff University. Welcome to the Jodcast.
Thank you.
So you work on dust in galaxies. Could you tell us about your research?
Well, I use the Herschel Space Observatory, which is the largest telescope flown into space, and it's quite a special camera because it's a far infrared and sub-millimeter camera, so it detects light that our eyes can't see. And it's really great because actually there's a lot of dust out there in the universe, and the dust blocks our visible light from our eyes and our telescopes, but we can recover that light using something like Herschel that's sensitive to the light from dust. So I'm actually really interested in where dust comes from, so where it's created, how it goes from something in the gas to being a solid particle, which is what we mean by cosmic dust, and also converting that to really big surveys with Herschel, where you get lots and lots of galaxies which have lots of dust in them, and trying to figure out what the dust tells you about how those galaxies change with time.
So when we say dust, is this the same kind of dust as you get on Earth, or is it different?
That's a really good question. It's not the same dust that we get on Earth, which is quite nice, because the dust we get on Earth is really gross. But what we're talking about is dust in space. So all we really mean is we're talking about solid particles, and most of these particles are about the same size of a smoke particle, actually, a few microns across. So you're talking about things that are made of carbon, iron, glassy materials, sometimes gems, you know, like diamonds, which is quite nice. And you've got all these solid particles, and they form out of the gas, a bit like snowflakes form out of the water vapour in our atmosphere, and then they get chucked into the galaxies. And so they get formed somewhere, they get chucked into galaxies. And the thing that's really crazy about dust is it's not very much when you look at the size of it. So again, it's kind of micron size, smoke size particles, but it makes a big difference to the way we view the universe. It blocks at least half of all the light in the universe, actually. All the light from stars and galaxies is blocked by dust grains, so it changes our view, hides half the universe from us. But it also is very important in helping stars to form, and without it we wouldn't see molecular hydrogen in galaxies. So it actually may even be crucial for water in the space between stars and galaxies. So we're talking about very small rocky things, and a big lump of dust could be the Earth, actually. So the Earth is just a huge lump of dust. We're actually bits of dust. If we were just floating in space, we'd be considered dust. And so that's kind of what dust is. And it's tiny, tiny fraction of the mass of a galaxy, but makes such a big difference in terms of the change of a galaxy and the evolution of stars and possibly even the building blocks of life as well.
So do we find dust in all kinds of galaxies?
Well, the quick answer is no. But it's actually something that's really quite a big question in the infrared community. And it's fair to say that we're behind the optical astronomers. Optical astronomers have had 400 years of using telescopes to look at the starlight from galaxies. But when you're looking in the infrared, you're looking at the light from the dust, the hidden starlight that's been reprocessed by dust. We've really only been able to do that since the late 90s, and that's because the instrumentation and the technology just hasn't been there. And we have to go to space, which makes it very expensive because of our own atmosphere. But what we do know is that if you ask that question now with the telescopes we have, like Herschel, we're able to say, no, spiral galaxies like the Milky Way, They have stars forming in them. They're kind of slightly more active. Our Milky Way is forming one star a year, and it has spiral arms. Those galaxies have dust, and actually a lot more dust than we can explain, in fact. But when you look at galaxies that we call ellipticals, so they have no spiral arms, they're elliptical in shape, and they're kind of dead systems. They don't have much gas in them, and there really seems to be a dearth of dust. So there's something in those galaxies that's effectively got rid of all the dust in them, whereas in spiral galaxies we do see a lot of dust.
Can you just explain a bit about the actual physical process then of how the dust emits this infrared light? You said it's reprocessed starlight.
That's right. So you have starlight, say, and then you put a little bit of dust in the way, so a little bit of carbon or maybe graphite, and this dust grain absorbs that starlight, so it just absorbs it. It's the perfect size to absorb the lights, and it heats up, it then cools down, and it re-radiates that light along a wavelength. So it really is stealing the optical light from our optical telescopes, absorbing it, and then re-emitting it at, or re-radiating that at longer wavelengths.
And can we talk a bit about Herschel? So how has Herschel changed things? How many galaxies are we seeing, things like that?
Well, Herschel is a huge leap in our observational understanding of the universe. We've gone from only seeing, in fact, since the late 90s, we've gone from only seeing at most 100 objects, and that actually sounds quite a lot, but there are a lot of galaxies in the universe. If you compare that to the Hubble data, where you've got hundreds of thousands and millions of them, it's quite embarrassing that in this regime we've only been looking at hundreds of galaxies, and they've always tended to be very bright or very rare objects, really kind of targeted, and they're not representative of what's actually out there. As an example, the SCUBA instrument, which was our best, you know, state-of-the-art instrument when I started my PhD, I won't say when that was, and that actually saw, in 51 hours of the best weather you can imagine from Mauna Kea in Hawaii, it saw at best three dusty galaxies, 51 hours of observational time. Herschel, in 16 hours, detects more than 7,000.
Wow.
So it's a huge leap in terms of numbers. The Herschel Atlas and the Hermes surveys, which are two big projects on Herschel, will end up getting hundreds of thousands of these dusty galaxies. Galaxies that you might not actually see in any other wavelength because they have so much dust, they're just obscuring all the starlight. And we're actually starting to see that infrared galaxies are actually kind of normal. There's some that are really big and bright, and there's some that are really faint, but on the whole, they're normal, and we've never had that capability before.
Well, that all sounds really interesting. Thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Woohoo! Thanks for that, Jen.
I love the woohoo at the end there. I think we should have more whooping at the end of interviews in general.
I agree. Hey, lots of excitement being interviewed on the Jodcast. And just to follow on from that interview with the woohooing, can't promise you any more of that though, we have Stephen Sargent, who has exciting new results from Herschel. Hello, joining me on the Jodcast today is Dr. Stephen Sargent from the Open University. Hello and welcome to the Jodcast.
Hello and thanks for having me.
Oh, it's brilliant. Now, you work on extragalactic surveys of star-forming galaxies. Could you tell me a bit about your research and how you do these surveys?
Sure. Well, I use a lot of space telescope data. So people think of space telescopes as just the Hubble Space Telescope. In fact, that's far from being the case. There are lots of space telescopes. I've used the Akari Space Telescope, a Japanese one. And I'm using now the Herschel Space Observatory, and it's the biggest telescope in space. It's got the biggest mirror of any telescope in space. And with it, we're painting the sky. We're doing the widest field survey that we can with it. It's actually, we're mapping 1% of the sky, and we're looking for bright galaxies bursting with star formation. So we're looking for the formation of galaxies like our Milky Way right out to almost all the way back to the Big Bang. And it's Herschel is fantastically sensitive. It's been a really, really good mission. So we're awash with data, and it's a great time to be in astronomy when you're just so awash with data. So, so we're having a great time.
And you have two main goals in this survey that you're interested in yourself. The mm-hmm. working on quasars,
mm-hmm.
and you're also working on gravitational lensing. So,
yeah.
Shall we start off with the quasars, and you can tell us what is a quasar and why you're excited by them?
Sure. Well, a quasar is a black hole in the centre of a galaxy. And this black hole is drawing in matter from this surrounding galaxy, and the matter is falling into the black hole, and by the friction that it's generated in the accretion disk that's forming around the black hole, it gets very, very hot. And so it's one of these strange paradoxes that you have the darkest thing in the universe that we know of, the black hole, surrounded by some of the brightest stuff that we know of in the universe. So this accretion disk can outshine the whole of the rest of the galaxy. So we look for these bright points where the black holes are accreting, and that's telling us where the activity is, where the black holes are growing. But there is a mystery associated with these black holes that we haven't yet unpicked, and that's one thing that I'm hoping that the Herschel Space Telescope will be able to tell us about. And that's the black hole properties are very closely connected to the properties of the galaxy that they're in. So the black hole mass is a fraction of a percent of the bulge of a spiral galaxy that it's in, or the elliptical galaxy that it's in. And yet, despite being a fraction of a percent, and a tiny, tiny fraction of the volume, it's very closely correlated. The masses are very closely correlated with properties of the wider galaxy. So something closely connected the growth of that black hole with the growth, the formation of the galaxy around it. So what we're hoping to do with Herschel is we want to find places where the black holes are growing. So we're finding places where we're seeing this bright accretion around black holes. And we're measuring the star formation rates in those quasars. So we want to see how and why there are these close, mysterious connections between the masses of black holes and the properties of the wider galaxies. And we think that Herschel will give us a lot of really useful clues about how this process is working.
Now, galaxies like our Milky Way, for example, go through several periods of star formation.
Mm-hmm.
Do these galaxies also have the same properties? And do you look at the first star formation? Is that what relates to the black hole mass, or is it all the star formation in the galaxy?
Actually, that's a really good and really deep question. We don't know a lot about how many times quasars turn on. One picture could be that there'll be just a very small number of very rare events that last a fair amount of time each. Or another picture of there very, very frequent times that a quasar is on. And we don't know a lot about when star formation is going on, so how often the star formation is going on. So, but I think the likely thing is that they go essentially hand in hand, and there'll be a handful of really key events where there's a lot of black hole growth and a lot of star formation going on in the host galaxy, and we'll be picking out just those few epochs in galaxies throughout most of the history of the universe.
And do you have any leading theories of what relates the star formation to the black hole growth?
Yeah, there are actually lots of theories. In fact, it's a really complicated physical process because we've got so much going on. You've got such a range of scales, and you've got such a lot of stuff going on because you can generate winds from the central accreting black hole that can be blowing out the gas, or maybe the gas could be encountering other gas and then coming, shocking and triggering more star formation. So actually, in principle, it could go either way. Unpicking the physics of how the black hole accretion is suppressing or enhancing star formation, it's very difficult because of the wide range of scales. Even in just in star formation, it's very hard to figure out what the triggers are and what the ratios of the small, the low mass objects to the high mass objects are, and it's what we call the initial mass function. It's just the physics of just star formation on its own is very, very hard. And unpicking how the quasar, the black hole accretion affects it it's very, very complicated. So actually what we really need are observational constraints. And that's the key thing that we're missing at the moment. And if we can find out how these things are linked, then we get a better handle. And in fact, we do have some early results already. We're finding that the star formation in quasars is not linearly correlated with the black hole accretion. So if you have a black hole that's accreting twice as much, you don't get twice as much star formation, you get a bit less. And that's already disagreeing with some theoretical models for how this feedback process is working. So it's early stages yet, and so we're hoping that Herschel will give us a lot more useful insights as time goes on.
So again, that's really exciting how the star formation rate is linked to the growth, but it's not a one-to-one correlation, so there must be some other process happening that is causing this difference.
It's wonderful to be at a time when a project is making lots and lots of new discoveries, and it's a really exciting time in far infrared and submillimeter astronomy now, because these facilities are making a whole bunch of discovery space accessible to us. A whole bunch of discoveries have only just become possible, so it's very, very exciting. And the quasar science is only one sort of science that we're doing with Herschel. The other big thing that we're very interested in at where I work is gravitational lensing. Now, what's happening here is that, so you're probably sitting in a chair listening to this, right? I mean, we're sitting in chairs here. Everyone is curving the space-time around them. So sitting in your chair right now, you are curving the space-time around you right now. But it's tiny, tiny effects. It's very, very difficult to measure. It's, in fact, for a human, it's impossible to measure. But for a giant astronomical object like the Sun, for example, or a galaxy or a cluster of galaxies, you can detect this warping. And in fact, you can even take an image of a cluster of galaxies, and you can see the background galaxies, galaxies that you're seeing through this foreground cluster. They look warped and stretched and pulled into arcs. And why they're pulled into arcs? Well, the reason is that the foreground cluster is warping the space and time around it. So you're seeing the warping of space and time by looking at these distant gravitational... It's called gravitational lensing. And what we're doing with Herschel is to find these strong gravitational lenses. And we've found a really powerful way of doing it.
This goes, what is this exciting way?
Well, the trick is that very bright, very luminous star-forming galaxies are very, very rare, and we can exploit that fact. There are lots of piddly little things. There are very, very few super bright ones. So if you see a super bright one, chances are that there's something else going on. So what we think is happening is you've got a piddly little one that's being boosted by this gravitational lensing effect. So what we're finding is you're painting the sky, looking for these very bright, bright, bright star-forming galaxies. And the ones that we see, these are strong gravitational lenses. These are like cosmic telescopes because the gravitational lensing, it makes them brighter. It also stretches the images. So we're getting a sharper view of the background distant universe. It's also brighter so that we can study them much, much more easily. So this is a fabulous new technique.
Without this effect of the gravitational lenses, would we be able to see these galaxies that are so far away in the background that are being beamed towards us?
Yes, but it's terribly hard because they're intrinsically much fainter. And there are surveys that are trying to do this. I mean, there are projects that are trying to do this. I don't want to belittle the excellent work that they're doing, but by exploiting this strong gravitational lensing of these far infrared galaxies, we can probe this distant galaxy population in a way that's never been possible before, at least for far infrared and submillimeter galaxies. And so this has been the big breakthrough that we've had. You see, it's been very, very hard work finding these strong gravitational lenses. And we're here at in Manchester, and this is the Jodcast, and one of the fantastic results from Jodrell Bank has been the gravitational lens survey. And this has been a really hard piece of work, trawling through tens of thousands of galaxies, looking for those rare few that are strong gravitational lenses. And it's been And it's a fantastic achievement by the Jodrell Bank, the class survey, is what it's called. So what we've found is that with Herschel, we don't have to sift through tens of thousands. We can get basically 100% selection efficiency. So in our first five candidates, we found all five were strong gravitational lenses. And this was, you know, fantastic, fantastic results. We were very, very excited by this. And so our plan is, this is something we're collaborating with guys here in Jodrell Bank and elsewhere, is to use the new E-Merlin telescope array to follow up these strong gravitational lenses. And so we'll unpick and see what's going on in these very distant galaxies of much sharper resolution than would otherwise be possible. So it's a really powerful new technique for finding these submillimeter galaxies. So we're very excited.
I have a question about this strong lensing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some ways in planet hunting, they use gravitational lensing to detect a planet, and they say you can't go back and look again. How come in strong lensing, the strong lensing effect, you can go back and do follow-up surveys?
Right. Yeah, that's because with these planet surveys, what you've got is you've got some background star, and you've got some foreground thing that's just drifting in front. And as it just lines up perfectly, the foreground star or planet or whatever is gravitationally boosting the background thing. But then it drifts away again. Now you could, if you knew the direction that it was going in, and you had a spaceship or something, you could go and you could reobserve. But that's, you know, we're kind of short of spaceships, so it's kind of tricky. But I mean, you could in principle. I mean, had been proposed, I think, for one interplanetary mission, could in principle have reobserved a microlens planet observation. But these are rare opportunities, so it's pretty tricky. But with our galaxies, the relative motions very, very, very slow. So we got plenty of time to go back. You know, it's eons that it would take. And it's kind of handy because then we have the opportunity to make these exquisitely high-resolution images that we would otherwise be completely inaccessible to us.
The light from these images have all been distorted in the gravitational lens.
Mm-hmm.
How do you put all that back together to get rid of the foreground object, I assume, is get corrupting your light? Mm-hmm. Is there a way for you to do that, to see properly what the galaxy's like?
Yeah, actually, the nature of these background galaxies is helping us because they are submillimeter wave detected galaxies. It turns out that these galaxies very, very dusty because it's dust that is radiating this far infrared light. This dust also makes the galaxies very red in optical light. So if you look in optical light, basically all that you're seeing are these foreground objects. But when you shift into the infrared light, you see the background galaxy appear. It's looking at the differences between what you're seeing in the optical and what you're seeing in the infrared that give you the handle as to what's background and what's foreground. So we've been taking data with the Keck telescopes, and even with this gigantic Keck telescope, we still couldn't detect anything at all from our background lensed galaxies. But when we looked at it with the infrared camera on the Hubble Space Telescope, then we've seen some absolutely exquisite, beautiful lens configurations, beautiful Einstein rings. That's been very, very exciting seeing these things.
And you've seen these like 20 hours ago for the first time. Very up to date on this.
Very, very up to date. So as a guy working at the Open University, Matty Negrello has just presented these in a conference in California just yesterday, in fact, and today I'm presenting them at Jodrell Bank and at the University of Manchester.
That's fantastic. So what is an Einstein ring? Is that just the lensing? Can you describe these images a bit?
Yeah, sure, of course. Well, imagine that you've got a foreground object and you've got a background object exactly lined up behind it. Okay, so the question is, what would you see? Well, there's a symmetry argument that if your foreground thing is symmetrical, circularly symmetric, and your background thing is circularly symmetric, say, then the image that you see has to be circularly symmetric because there's nothing in this configuration to give it any preferred direction. And so there has to be a ring shape. So the background object, which is some background splodge, will be stretched into a circle around this foreground object. And this stretching into a circle is exactly what we're seeing with these Hubble Space Telescope data that we've literally just hot off the press.
They're absolutely fantastic data. The images are, it's hard to say on a podcast like this, just how fantastic an image actually is. But I'm sure we'll try and find a way to show you that image eventually, at least.
Yep, when we can, when we publish it, and we'll do a press release image, and we'll certainly pass it on to you so you can host it on whatever web pages you like.
The lens object, I was looking on this image you showed in your talk today, is 11 billion years ago in the past, or something like that, whereas the galaxy, what's doing the lensing, is 3 billion years ago, which is a massive difference. What's quite surprising is those objects in the past, so far away, are producing stars. Are these objects still producing stars now? I mean, it's 11 billion years ago.
Ah, now that's a really good question. And we think that the star formation will happen in bursts. So probably that burst won't have lasted for that long. And so it will have died away and maybe have a few more bursts in the meantime. But the really subtle thing is that whether it's the same object, because what's happening is that galaxies are colliding with galaxies and merging. So right now, our galaxy has galaxies that are orbiting it and being drawn in. So it's accreting the Magellanic Cloud galaxies. And we ourselves are falling towards the Andromeda galaxy. And in 4 or 10 billion years, we'll collide. And there'll be some combined giant galaxy that we make. So let's suppose that there's some astronomer in the distant future. They see our galaxy, they'll see the Andromeda galaxy. And then someone asks the question, well, are these galaxies still forming stars? But by the time that they're observing it, we'll have merged and merged again and probably merged again with other things. And so it becomes quite difficult to say to track the identity of an object through cosmic time like that. So it's a surprisingly complicated and subtle question. It's about the merger history of galaxies, the star formation history of galaxies. And just even expressing it in words becomes quite tricky.
And are these galaxies like what our Milky Way is now? Are they spirals, or can you tell anything like about them?
It's early days with our lens reconstruction, but they're certainly resolved into knots of star formation, and there's structure there that we're seeing. So they're probably the progenitors of elliptical galaxies. But that doesn't mean that they're going to look elliptical at those redshifts. They're going to look like something else.
And also, you showed us in your talk, these objects have water lines and CO lines.
Yes, there's been a very nice result from Alain Aumont detecting water from Plateau de Burr in these distant galaxies. What you can tell is you can learn about the environment that the molecules are in. You can learn about the densities of the gas. You can learn about how many ionizing photons they're seeing, what sort of environment they're in. And the interesting thing is that from this spectroscopic data, from these emission lines that we're seeing, it looks like there's an active nucleus in there. So there is an accreting black hole lurking inside this otherwise star-forming galaxy. So this is another example of how useful the gravitational lensing is that it's much easier to do these observations because of the boosting that this gravitational lensing has given us.
Brilliant. What's next?
Well, we will be releasing, we already have released some data to the public. And by the public, I mean generally the astronomical community, but anyone can download data from the Herschel Space Telescope. And we have reduced images. You can have a great swathe of the sky that you can now see. And we've got images tailored for the public as well. So GIFs and JPEGs, that sort of thing. So there's a lot to rummage, and we'll be making more and more data releases as the survey goes on that anyone can download. So go have a play, do please.
Oh, lovely pictures. That's the great thing about astronomy. You get to see so many pretty pictures, and you've got loads with ice diamonds and everything. In gravitational lensing, you're looking quite far back in terms of time and the early. You're close to the earlier universe, aren't you?
Well, actually, it's one of the amazing things that you can see galaxies through most of the history of the universe. In fact, all right, I contend that cosmologists are much luckier than particle physicist, let's say. Okay, so if you're a particle physicist, you could ask a question, a really fundamental, important, engaging question that could be completely impossible to answer. So if you're interested in M theory or superstring theory or something, your really fundamental interesting questions could be completely inaccessible to experiment. You need gigantic galactic-sized particle accelerators to do it. And you just, there's no chance you would ever be able to do that. But in cosmology, you can see galaxies nearly all the way back to the Big Bang. And that to me is absolutely staggering that that is possible, that it's technologically feasible, that it's affordable, that we can do it at all is just stunning. I think we have a real privilege to be doing cosmology and to have the accessible questions. And also, right now is a really fantastic, exciting time in cosmology, because all of the big questions that you could ask about the fate of the universe, the content of the universe, how all of the galaxies came and together and formed, where all the spiral disks came from, and how the bulges of spirals came about, and how the links to the black holes in the centres, where it all came from. All of these fundamental questions are being answered right now, so it's a fantastically exciting time in cosmology right now.
Well, following on from that, mm-hmm. From the Big Bang, there's just the building blocks of matter, and there's no stars or anything like that. But suddenly, then you suddenly see these galaxies appearing.
Mm-hmm.
How did they suddenly, be there?
Yeah, that's a really deep question. It's what generated the first light in the universe? So you have the early universe. The universe eventually is expanding, becomes transparent. It's dark. There's nothing in it. Just gas. And then the gas condenses down and forms the first stars and the first galaxies. So, I mean, gravity is the reason that these things happen, is that it just needs slight perturbations from uniformity. It's very unstable to form in clumps of stuff. And so stuff falls together and forms the first stars and the first galaxies. But as to what they looked like, the very, very first luminous things in the universe, we still don't know. And we will have to wait for telescopes like the James Webb Space Telescope to give us the first insights. Also the Square Kilometre Array, when that comes, that will give us the first insights.
So wow, these lens objects that are 11 billion years ago aren't even close to being the first objects. There's a long way to go yet.
They're very early, and they are most of the way to the Big Bang. But there is this small window of time when the very, very first things... as a fraction of the history of the universe, it's a really tiny shard, but it's a really interesting tiny shard at the very, very earliest times, and we'll be probing that with the next generation of facilities, and that's, as I say, it's a fantastically exciting time.
Another part of your life is you are a science consultant for Bango's The Theory and other TV shows.
Oh my goodness, yes.
Can you tell us, what do you do, and how do you come up with concepts?
Oh, right, well, what we do, I'm leading a team, it's not just me, I'm leading a team of about a dozen people who are consulting on this Bango's The Theory TV show. The first thing we do is check that stuff is working, the scripts that they're going to be talking through are factually correct, and we can also give them pointers on where the hot science is, because the BBC, the broadcasters, are not scientists themselves. So they ask us, what's hot, where's stuff going, where are the exciting areas. Although, of course, the BBC have the editorial say. I mean, it's quite right that we ourselves are not broadcasters. So. But so we check for factual errors, and mostly it works out and stuff doesn't slip through, but there have been a few things that have been not quite perfect, but hey, it's telly, and it's brilliant telly. It's really, really good. And what I really love is that, especially actually with the most recent series of Bango's The Theory, is you've got it's the studio discussions. That's what I really like. It's you have intelligent people talking intelligently about scientific topics at a time which is opposite Coronation Street, and that's just fantastic. I mean, you could say it's what the BBC is for. It's just brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant that it's bringing science in a completely accessible way to a very, very, to a huge audience. Yeah, millions and millions of people. So it's wonderful being involved in that.
And do you have any favourite ideas? Have you come up with any of the ideas for this show?
Yes, some. I can't say too much because there'll be stuff that'll be broadcast a little bit later. So we're in discussions already now about the Series 5 of Bango's The Theory, and I like the way that the Sirius has grown. It's now got a lot more. It doesn't need to be showy or to impress. It's now a really thoughtful and interesting content. Particularly in the last series, there was an item on genetically modified foods, and that was really thoughtful, engaging content. And there's more on. There's more. I can't go into the details on that, but I mean, there's astronomy is something they're particularly interested in on Bangosa Theory. So I would I keep watching.
I feel like I should be on Doctor Who now and saying spoilers or something.
Spoiler alert!
Spoilers. And have you had any really favourite things that's been on the show?
Well, in series one, they got Marek Kakula and flung him around, or Marek was flinging around one of the presenters in a dark matter demonstration. That was that was kind of fun to watch.
Oh, fantastic! Oh, it sounds like such an exciting thing to be able to consult on a TV show as popular as that. I mean, it's a fantastic show. I love it.
Yeah, it's broadcasting has a very different set of intellectual values. It's wonderful to be involved in that, such as an alien intellectual discipline as broadcasting, and in fact. Jogcast too. It's brilliant.
Do you know what? It's been an absolute pleasure being on the Jogcast. It's been fascinating. It's brilliant.
Right. Thanks for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks for that, Libby.
And now for the bit we can't fit in anywhere else, the odds and ends section of the show.
Okay, so first, we have some exciting results from Gravity Probe B, which is a space gyroscope, which was launched in 2004, even though it started being commissioned in 1963. Can you imagine, like, a 40-year-old project?
Were they doing for 40 years?
I think they were developing the technology mostly, because, you know, between the time they have the idea and the time they have the technology, it takes some time. But the telescope was launched in 2004 and has been observing for 6 years. It was decommissioned in December 2010. It was looking, basically, at the effect of the rotation of the Earth on space-time and how, according to Einstein's general theory of relativity, if the Earth is rotating in space-time, it's like if it was rotating a little bit like in honey, it would make space-time twist. And so if you're looking at a point in space, a fixed point in space, if you want to stay on the same position, you'll have to slightly rotate, which is why they use the gyroscope telescope to do that. This telescope was looking at one star, IM Picassi, and it looked at it for a very long time, and it was recording if it had to rotate to stay on position with the star. And it did, which means that space-time was rotating, which confirmed Einstein's theory, which is pretty exciting. Woo!
So the Earth's rotation is actually making the space-time around it slightly swirly-shaped.
Yes, exactly. That's the idea.
That's cool. I'm glad we know that.
Well, I'm mostly glad that you can actually see it and test it. I never thought that it was testable.
So we must be seeing really, really, really tiny changes.
It does. It does. But it can still record it, which is really impressive.
So that is a really exciting new test of general relativity.
That's what they've been waiting the 40 years for then, I guess.
Pretty much, I think.
On the 30th of April, there was a very unusual case of astronomy coming to the astronomers when a meteorite smashed through somebody's roof in a small village in Poland. It was actually on a farm. It broke through the roof and then hit the ground and smashed into a number of pieces. And yeah, well, fortunately not. It didn't hit anybody. That would have been really unlucky, I think. I've never heard of anyone getting hit by a meteorite. But the farm owner, according to what I've read, Mrs. Alfreda, heard the sound and then she found it on the ground and actually picked up a 1 kilogram piece of this thing and it was still warm. And the end was sort of rounded because it had been moulded by heat of the atmosphere, and I suppose that's how it made it through, because most meteorites that size would just burn up.
You should definitely play the lottery, because I think chances of having a meteorite go through your roof compared to the chances of winning the lottery
probably smaller than winning the lottery.
So what are they going to do with this bag of sugar weighted meteorite?
Yes, it is roughly the weight of a big bag of sugar. It's been taken away to be analysed at, I don't know if I'm pronouncing this correctly, but the Wrocław University of Technology in Poland. So they're going to analyse its chemical composition, try and see where it came from.
Exciting times. So we can find out if it's from the debris disk of our solar system formation, if it's pre-solar system, or if it was created in some processing events of the comets. Oh, yay, I might get to see some of this data. That's really exciting. I wonder if people collect these things.
I know that people collect cars on which meteorites have fallen. I don't know about houses.
roofs. That might be a bit of, like, space-consuming hobby.
That piece of roof could end up in a museum. Apparently that's probably where the meteorite is going to be in the long term.
Oh, wow.
Cool.
There is a few exciting events coming up. First, in Intec in Hampshire near Winchester, they are doing a series of events for the deaf and hard of hearing on the 22nd of May. So this includes planetarium shows and talks with sign language and also subtitles. Also, other events. Mark, I think, has got the latest news for this.
Yeah, on the 15th of June, there's going to be a lunar eclipse. Mm-hmm. And, yep, that's definitely a whooping event, I think. And the Museum of Science and Industry in Manchester is once again letting us, that's University of Manchester astronomers, in to do things in their museum, give talks and planetarium shows, and help them set up various events which you can come down and see.
It's going to be very exciting. So if you're around Manchester, do come and see us. You won't regret it.
It's going to be taking place from 5 to 9 p.m. Obviously, the lunar eclipse, being as it's near midsummer, is not actually going to be visible until about 10 p.m. So, as a special treat, we're all going off to a bar on the 23rd floor of the tallest building in Manchester, the Hilton Hotel, from where we hope to see the moon rise in eclipse if it's not cloudy.
Let's really hope it's not cloudy. I really want to see that eclipse, and I really want to see it from the Hilton.
You get an awesome view. You can see all the way to the Lovell Telescope, and apparently even Blackpool Tower on a clear day.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so we were up there preparing for this event, and we were looking, and we could just see this white sheen on the horizon, and we're thinking, that's in the direction of Jodrell Bank. Is it the telescope? And then we saw it move position, so it's just on the edge of what you can resolve, but it was pretty cool.
Cool.
So seeing the moon like that will be fantastic.
The event is aimed at ages 14 and up, and you'll have to be over 18 to come into the bar, which is called Cloud 23.
So we hope to see some of you there.
Yep, you're all invited.
If you want to know more about lunar eclipses or any other questions about astronomy, you can write into the show, and that leads nicely on to Ask an Astronomer with Tim.
So the first question this month is from Greg, and he's basically asking about the relationship between maths and astronomy, and he wants to know basically whether maths is essential to the pursuit of astronomy, whether it be as a professional astronomer or as a hobbyist astronomer. Well, I think in the latter case, if you're really looking at doing astronomy as a hobby, really, in your spare time, then you definitely don't need maths. You can basically just go out there, use your eyes for the first thing, get yourself a pair of binoculars, get yourself a small telescope. You can do interesting things. You can work out, one of the most exciting things I did with my own telescope was finding the Crab Nebula, but just from my back garden with a small telescope. And it's not a very bright thing, but basically you just get some software like Stellarium or something like that, find out where it is relative to the bright stars, and then use your telescope to sort of find the patterns of bright stars and work your way from brighter to fainter and fainter stars until eventually you spot this sort of fuzzy object. And to be honest, even though what you see is nothing like as spectacular as what you see with on the web, with HST images of the Crab Nebula or something, the very fact that you found it yourself is where all the enjoyment is, I think. So there's definitely something to be done there without maths. If you want to be a professional astronomer, then yep, sure, you do need maths. But even the range of capability of professional astronomers in mathematics is quite high. So some people are, basically very mathematical. Some people, they're competent, but they don't need, they don't need mathematics particularly an advanced level to do the research that they do. For myself, I actually started off I did a PhD in astronomy that was purely theoretical. So it was entirely a mathematical exercise, initially basically pen and paper mathematics, and then developed into a sort of computational application of a model. And I never even looked through a telescope, to be honest, during the whole of my PhD. These days I do, but it's sort of, it just varies from one person to another as to what you need. So the second question is from Willie Wilson, and it's all about our Milky Way galaxy and other galaxies. First of all, he asks, is the plane of our solar system the same as the plane of the Milky Way? Well, you'll know that most of the planets in our solar system orbit in basically the same flat plane. And the Milky Way, if you've seen the Milky Way, you'll see it as a bright band of light running across the sky. That's basically the disk, the flattened disk of our Milky Way galaxy that we're sort of seeing edge on. Well, those two planes are not, they're not the same. So in fact, our solar system is about 60 degrees, to the plane of the Milky Way. So we're sort of at an angle to it. He then asks about, is there matter, gas or stars lying above and below the galactic plane? And if so, how is this matter distributed? Well, as I say, our galaxy is a disk galaxy. So most of the, stars and gas and dust are actually concentrated into this really quite, thin disk. It's something like, for the stellar disk is something like 30,000 parsecs across. 30 kiloparsecs across in diameter, but its thickness at its thickest it's really only about something like a kiloparsec across. The dust and gas disk sort of extends farther out in terms of diameter than the stellar disk, but they're still relatively thin compared to the diameter. And when you look at it in detail, there is actually a very thin disk sort of in the middle of the disk, if you like, which is made of the coldest gas, for example, the sort of molecular hydrogen. And then as the gas sort of gets warmer, whether it's been maybe the sort of stuff that's been ionized and heated up by hot young stars, that sort of puffs up, as you might imagine, as it gets hotter, and so you get a slightly thicker disk. So there's certainly structure to the disk, but most of the gas and dust and stars is in this relatively thin disk. However, that does appear to be embedded in a sort of spheroidal, more or less spherical halo, which does contain some stars and does contain some gas, but is dominated by dark matter. So most of the mass of our galaxy is actually in this so-called dark matter halo. And then Willie also asks about why is there a central bulge in our galaxy? If you've seen pictures of other spiral galaxies, disk galaxies, seen edge-on particularly, you'll see that the central part sort of bulges out. So you've got this sort of thinnish disk, but with this big central bulge in the middle. And our galaxy is no different. It does appear to have this central bulge. Now, to be honest, this is still discussed. The origin of bulges in galaxies is still discussed. Traditionally, we'd think about them as having the old stars, whereas the youngest stars are being made still continually in the disk as the sort of spiral waves pass through it. And so the bulge probably formed early, maybe in as little as maybe a billion years, but about 10 billion years ago, early on in the formation of the galaxy, and the disk sort of formed later and continues to form new stars. But as we've sort of studied these things in more detail, we've realised it's more complicated, as you might imagine. For example, our galaxy, that bulge, you know, is basically bar-like. It's sort of, you know, it's not a spherical bulge, it's sort of extended along an axis. And it could well be that perhaps in our galaxy, but certainly in other galaxies, some of these bulges are actually really their instabilities which are causing the sort of inner part of the disk to sort of puff up as this sort of bar instability develops. But it still seems like the stars are much older in these bulges than they are in the sort of gassy disk farther out, which has got new star formation. Following on from that question, we've got a question from Jim Momans, who's in Virginia, and he says, while landing in a plane on a very windy day, I began to wonder if galaxies wobble. Many galaxies rotate, ours does. Do galaxies also pitch, yaw and roll as they move through space? So it's a good question. Yep, we've just been talking about our galaxy and having this disk. The orbits of stars within that disk, they're basically all, we're orbiting around the middle of our Milky Way as we orbit round and round that disk. But in fact, it turns out that's not a very uniform situation. So in fact, our galaxy, our disk galaxy and others that we can see in space are warped. So if you were to sort of see, you can see this pictures of some galaxies seen edge on, instead of seeing a sort of flat horizontal plane for the disk, they're more like a sort of slightly S shape. So one side of the disk would sort of bend down and the other end of the disk would bend up. And that seems to be the case for our own as well. It's most obviously seen in observations with radio telescopes of the atomic hydrogen, but it seems to be the case for the stars as well. So one way to visualize this is to think about the orbits of the stars around and around the Milky Way as circles. And so you get this big sort of set of concentric circles as you move out from the middle. And then if you took each of those rings, basically, that you've got for each orbit, and you sort of tilted them at an angle, and you did it in a way, in a sort of smooth way, so that you could, you sort of created this sort of S-shaped warp. That's what it looks like, the disks are warped like. And it actually seems like the axis through which you tilt it can rotate as well as you work your way out through the galaxy. So you don't all sort of tilt them in exactly the same direction. You can rotate the angle at which you tilt these orbits. So I guess that's one way in which galaxies don't rotate in the way you'd expect. You might ask, why are these things warped? And of course, that's what astronomers do ask. And the current ideas are focused around the fact that we think that galaxies, formed in this sort of hierarchical sort of merging. So smaller galaxies merged together over the history of the universe to make larger galaxies. And that would result basically in a galaxy like our own is not just isolated in space. There are other galaxies that merge with ours. And even now we can see these sort of dwarf galaxies that are being ripped apart as they sort of plow into our own Milky Way. The Andromeda galaxy is coming towards us, for example, and will merge with us in about 3 billion years or so. And when that happens, you can imagine that the gravitational influence of this merging other mass composed of stars, gas and dark matter actually causes a perturbation on the orbits of the stars and the gas in the other galaxy. And that can basically induce these warps. And so you've got a situation where you definitely can have a situation where a galaxy is sort of spinning in space, but it's basically getting kicked and pushed and pulled by all these other interactions, as well as its own naturally generated instabilities within its own structure. So yeah, I would say they can sort of pitch and yaw, if you like, but basically because of the interactions with other merging galaxies. And just one other thing on that topic. We talked about disk galaxies a lot, but maybe about a third of galaxies are actually elliptical, rather than being flattened disks. And we think they're actually rather grandly called triaxial ellipsoids, a triaxial ellipsoid. If you imagine a rugby ball, or in Jim's case in Virginia there, maybe an American football, is a sort of egg-shaped thing. If you could sort of sit on that and squash it, then you've got a sort of triaxial ellipsoid. And the orbits of the stars in those are more randomised than, say, in the disk galaxy, where they're all sort of going round and around the centre. They're basically not all in the same plane. And the reason for that is because we think that these elliptical galaxies are formed by the mergers of disk galaxies. So if you took two disk galaxies, like, say, Andromeda and the Milky Way, and they sort of merge together, and they'll be at a sort of random angle to each other, then you can imagine the gravitational influence on the stars as they sort of hit into each other. That causes the orbits to sort of be mixed up. And that results in something that's quite a complex sort of shape that can even sort of be tumbling, if you like, as it moves through space, because of the sort of gravitational, the torques that are acting on it because of these interactions. Next question is from Ian Kennedy, and he asks, if the universe is expanding and everything is moving apart, how come galaxies collide? Well, it's a good question, of course, and if you're not being careful, you'll hear people say that what Hubble discovered was that when he looked out into space and looked at all these galaxies other than our own and measured their redshifts, basically measured the Doppler shift of the light that's coming from them, he found that they were all redshifted and therefore that all these galaxies are moving away from us. That's what somebody would say if they weren't being careful. What they ought to say, at the very least, is to say that all the distant galaxies are moving away from us, because as we just mentioned, the Andromeda galaxy is actually moving towards us. So it's definitely not redshifted, it's blue-shifted. And if you were being even more careful, you'd probably not even say the distant galaxies are moving away from us, you'd probably say clusters of galaxies are moving away from us. And the reason for all this is basically because if galaxies are relatively close by, then gravity basically wins over the sort of cosmic expansion. And so basically the gravity between, for example, the Milky Way and Andromeda and other galaxies in our local group, we're in a group or a small cluster basically where we're orbiting one another, and we might actually be heading towards one another and merge in the future. But if you pick that sort of group or small, that cluster, and you picked another cluster at a much larger distance, then those clusters would be moving away from each other due to the expansion of the universe. And basically the speed, if you pick sort of two galaxies in a group or a cluster, that are orbiting one another or orbiting the centre of the cluster basically, then the typical mass of a cluster would tell you the typical speeds at which the galaxies are moving within it. So just like the speed of the planets orbiting the Sun is determined by the mass of the Sun largely, that dominates, and that's what gives you the force of gravity that keeps a planet in orbit. That's what will actually determine the speed of its orbit. So you can get the speeds of these galaxy orbits from the mass of the cluster, and they're typically something like several hundred kilometers per second, maybe 300 kilometers per second, say, is the speed at which a galaxy moves within a cluster. Now, if you know anything about the expansion of the universe, you might know about Hubble's law. And what Hubble found in Hubble's law is he found that the speed at which these distant galaxies are moving away from us is proportional to their distance. And that's a natural consequence of an expanding universe model, where every point's moving away from every other point, and at some distant time in the past, every point was on top of every other point. So you can actually use Hubble's law, which just tells you that the speed at which they're moving away from us is equal to, it's proportional to distance, and the proportionality constant is called Hubble's constant. So V equals H naught D, where V is velocity, H naught is Hubble's constant, and D is the distance. So you could say, okay, well, if I want the Hubble expansion to dominate over this sort of motion of galaxies within clusters, then I want the speed due to the expansion of the universe in Hubble's law to be bigger than something like 300 kilometers per second. And you can stick into that equation what we know of Hubble's constant at the moment, what we've measured, and you can work out basically that for that to dominate, for the expansion velocity due to the expansion of the universe to dominate over the velocities in clusters, then the distance needs to be something like several tens of megaparsecs, millions of parsecs away. So maybe 30 or 40 megaparsecs, then you know that anything beyond about that distance, these so-called peculiar velocities, the sort of random components of velocities due to motions of galaxies and clusters, is much smaller than the velocity due to the expansion of the universe. Question from David Entwistle, who is basically asking about the arrangement of new radio telescope systems. He's talking about things like SKA, square kilometre array, LOFAR, low frequency array, and so on. And he's saying, looking at the arrangement of the aerials in the various new radio telescope systems, it looks fairly random. Why is that, and how is the arrangement decided upon? Well, basically all these sorts of systems, whether it be LOFAR, whether it be E-Merlin here in the UK, whether it be SKA, they're all interferometers. So basically what we do is we take signals from individual elements, whether they look like aerials or whether they look like dishes, individual telescope dishes, and we combine those signals in pairs. So if any of you have heard of Young's double slit experiment, it's a bit like that. You take these two signals from a pair of telescopes and you combine them together. And so if you think about this big distribution of antennas, the sort of telescopes, or the aerials, for example, and they're spread around and you combine all the different pairs together, you get many different pairs if you've got lots of elements. When you do that, that's how we make the image. But basically the things that are important there are the separations of the two elements and the angle of the two elements, a line joining the two elements, as sort of projected onto the sky. And the separation tells us what the resolution of that element pair is. So the farther apart the two elements, the sort of finer detail we would see, so the sharper the view. The closer together the two elements, that's sensitive to the sort of broader, sort of low frequency, if you like, broader structures, more blurred out structures on the sky. Long spacings, large spacings between elements give you the finer detail. So what you'd want in any good interferometer system is a combination of both short spacings and long spacings, and all the ones in between. And of course, a single giant dish has all spacings, right? Because basically it's got every element across the whole surface of the dish. It's got tiny spacings between very neighbouring parts of the dish, and it's got the very long spacings between opposite sides of the dish. So an array of these elements has to have a mix of short spacings and long spacings. But also the angle between any two pairs, what you want is a mix of different angles. So you're sensitive to variations in the brightness on the sky that are directed along different directions in the sky. Excuse me. Yeah, so that's what you're trying to do. And of course the problem is that you're always limited by cost. So you're going to have a limited number of elements. So that's the first thing. So in the case of E-Merlin, we've only got up to 7 telescopes. For SKA, hopefully, we'll have thousands of elements. So we're a bit better off there. But that's one limitation, how many you've got. So you do the best you can with the number you've got. And the other limitations are things like the terrain. So if you're spreading them across a large area, you've got to have somewhere suitable to site these elements. You've also got infrastructure costs. You've got data transport costs because you've got to link these things together. And typically what happens, for example, with SKA, people have been modeling what, basically you can model what quality of image you get by positioning the antenna in various different patterns. And at the moment we've got sort of a sort of pseudo-random Gaussian distribution in the central core. So pseudo-random, it's not exactly random positioning. Gaussian means that there's more of them spaced closer together in the middle, and then the spacings get slightly larger as you go farther out. And then actually there's these sort of logarithmic spiral arms that basically spiral out from the middle. And you can, you know, you can try and calculate this analytically, but also these days you would do that computationally and work out what the most efficient way of positioning these elements is to get a good mix of short spacings, medium spacings, long spacings, and a good mix of angles between all the various pairs. And again, as I say, does depend on how you're going to actually connect together these individual elements to make the various different units. So it's not trivial, but hopefully that's the basic point. Good mix of spacings, good mix of angles, and that's what will give you the best quality image. Okay, the final question this month is from Mark Randalls, and he asks about the New Horizons space probe, which is on its way to Pluto. And he says, when can we expect to begin to get pictures of Pluto using the New Horizons probe that are of better quality and resolution than the ground-based and Hubble pictures so far obtained? Well, yeah, New Horizons is on its way to Pluto. It's actually launched in January of 2006, and it should arrive at Pluto in 2015, basically. So it's, as he says, it's about just over halfway there now. Well, let's just have a look at the sort of quality and resolution. So that's the sharpness of, say, the Hubble pictures of Pluto. They're actually not that great. And to illustrate why, the resolution of Hubble's cameras, the pixels are about 0.05 arc seconds across. Now an arc second is 1/3600th of a degree. You know, and the full moon is half a degree across. So these are, you know, very, very tiny pixels, which is why you're getting a very nice sharp images of the sky with Hubble, obviously flying above the atmosphere to get above atmospheric blurring. But Pluto currently is about 31 astronomical units away. So an astronomical unit is the distance between the Earth and the Sun. So it's 31 times the distance between the Earth and the Sun away from us at the moment, which is about 4.6 billion kilometres away. And the diameter of Pluto is only 2,300 kilometres, smaller than the Moon. So if you work that out, it turns out that the sort of the angular diameter of Pluto, so the angle it would sort of measure on the sky, if you sort of pointed at the top of Pluto and then moved your arm to point at the bottom of Pluto, with the angle through which your arm would move, is only about 0.1 arc seconds. So that's a tenth of a 3,600th of a degree. So in terms of comparing that to Hubble, we said Hubble's pixels were about 0.05. So basically Pluto is 2 Hubble Space Telescope pixels across. So you're not going to get a great image of Pluto with the Hubble Space Telescope. And the sort of best images you might have seen on the web are sort of reconstructed. There's been some sort of clever image processing that basically tries to show you some surface details on Pluto, but they're really very, very crude. So yeah, you'd think that New Horizons is on its way there. Obviously, at some point, it'll start getting better pictures than the Hubble Space Telescope can get from here, from Earth, basically. Now, on board New Horizons, the highest resolution camera is a thing called LORI, L-O-R-R-I, which is the long-range reconnaissance imager. So the sort of resolution of LORI is 20 times worse than HST. Now, you might think, oh, why is it so bad? Well, one reason it's so bad is actually because the telescope aperture, the telescope that's used, the sort of lens, if you like, the telescope that's used to image onto the camera in LORI is only a 21 centimetre aperture telescope, whereas Hubble is a 2.4 metre aperture telescope. So, and the bigger the aperture of the telescope, just as we were just discussing with the elements in a radio telescope array, the farther apart the elements are on your dish, if you like, in your mirror in this case, the higher resolution you get, the finer detail you see. So because Hubble's got a much bigger mirror, that gives it much higher resolution. And also it depends on the actual physical size of the pixels on your camera, on your chip as well, in your CCD. So, given that LORI is 20 times worse than HST, it'd need to be sort of 20 times closer to get an equivalent resolution. And so, distance from Earth to Pluto is currently about 31 AU. So you'd actually need to be something like my calculations suggest that you'd need to be only about 1.6 AU away to be equivalent to the resolution, for the resolution of LORI to be equivalent to the resolution of Hubble. So it'd need to be getting quite close, 1.6 Earth-Sun distances away from Pluto before it starts to be equivalent to Hubble. Its current distance away from Pluto is about 12 astronomical units. So it's a while yet. And in fact, if you have a look on the web, on New Horizons website, you'll find that they say they'll start resolving surface features in the summer of 2014. So unfortunately, we've still got another 3 years or so to wait before we start to see these sort of resolution of the sort of surface light and dark patterns on Pluto. Obviously, by the time that New Horizons gets to Pluto, then it's going to be so close up that in fact we're going to get some stunning pictures of Pluto with it, but not for a while yet, I'm afraid. Okay, that's it for Ask an Astronomer for another month. If you'd like to send in your questions for next time, do so by all the various usual routes.
Thanks for that, Tim. Now we're on to the feedback section of the show, where we round up all the posts, emails, etc. we have got in the last couple of weeks.
We want to say get well soon to Mark Randalls, who sent us a letter, and also thanks very much for your question.
On the forum we have Earth Unit, who would like to say how great it was listening to the Jodcast with his new t-shirt.
On Twitter, I would like to send a big thank to my friend Polaris.ca, who advertised the Jodcast for our friends in Canada.
So hello to any new listeners in Canada.
And on Facebook, Susan Kelly got in touch and said that we had a really action-packed episode for May 2011. Two conferences, heaps of interviews, and Stuart hurling himself in front of a bus, which she says was worth it. So we'll pass that on to Stuart. Obviously, the bus wasn't really moving very quickly at the time.
No Stuarts or buses were injured in the making of the Jodcast. So that's it for the show this time. If you want to get in touch with us, you can do so via the website at www.jodcast.net.
On the forum at forum.jodcast.net.
On Facebook at jodcast.net/Facebook.
At Twitter at twitter.com/jodcast.
On YouTube at youtube.com/jodcast.
On Flickr at flickr.com/groups/jodcast. So thank you very much to Haley Gomez, Karen Masters and Stefan Sargent for their interview.
The editors were Mark Perver, Melanie Gendre, Jen Gupta and Tim O'Brien.
And the producer was Libby Jones.
So until next time, jod on!